Well, thank you very much for coming to this second lecture, of five. And today I'm going to be concentrating on Old English, the language. Nothing like I did yesterday, which was the run-through grammar. This is a bit more about the story of a language, and in this particular case, the history of English. Usual notification about mobile phones. If you've got one, put them on silent, please. Don't answer them, etc., etc. Apologies, I said this yesterday. I did put everything up on WebLearn, and then I forgot to allow you in. So sorry about that. You're in now. You can get in and get all the stuff. So I'll send another note round when these goes up and you can just get the stuff down. So what I want to do today, we're going to start with some literature just because I thought that would be a bit, get you broken into some literature. And then I'm going to talk about where English comes from and its relationship to other languages, why there are different forms of English, pronunciation of English, how Old English works, is not something I'm going to really concentrate on because that's what I'm doing in the grammar, but hopefully you'll have picked that up to a certain degree. Okay, so if you've got a handout in front of you, don't worry if you haven't, but there is a poem there called The Ruin, and it's taken from Hamer's Choice of Anglo-Saxon Verse, that's the page that I've put up, and it's kind of nice. There it is, if you haven't got it in front of you. Because it gives you what's called a facing translation. Now, if you've had a chance to read this, great. If you haven't, basically, it's a shortish poem in Old English entitled The Ruin, about a person looking at a ruined building and musing on the transient nature of life, etc. So what I tend to do, this is just about, in terms of literary analysis, this will seem very simple to you, but it is important when you're doing Old English. The first thing is try to work out what's actually happening in the poem, where is it about, who's speaking, try to get that quite clear, because you will find it's quite abstract, some Old English poetry. What is the message of the poem? What devices does the poet use in this particular poem? And I'm just using this as a simple example to get you interested in Old English poetry. It's a good poem, I might add, but anyway. Now, if we look at the page, so we have modern English, Old English, and you might see some words in the Old English and link them to the modern English. You might see none there, but anyway, there are some there and some similarities. And we can see it's, 30 lines long on this page. There's a few more lines. Something odd's going on here, and notably, the layout of the poetry in Old English is quite interesting. There's this, what we call a caesura, this white space down the middle. I'll do more on poetry next week. And there's the second bit, as you can see. Still similar idea, two half lines, lots of dots here, something's very much odd going on here, what's going on in the poem. So, if I was to do it, basically what the poem is about is a person looking, an Anglo-Saxon, looking at a ruin. Very probably a Roman ruin, because it talks about baths, and most people conjecture that it is Bath, that this is a poem written about that, but there's various interpretations of it. And of course, what they're saying is that I'm looking at this once was a splendid building and it's all gone. The glory of whatever this was has gone. And they are taking from that the fact that all worldly glory will pass away. And you might come across this phrase, leaf is lana in Old English. And basically it means life is on loan, which is a lovely way of saying that what you've got to worry about is what comes after life. Okay. And stylistic, if you read through it, it's what we call an elegy in that sense. It's very simple. He's comparing the past with the present, and he uses images of colour and sound and weather. So it's particularly grey and cold and miserable in the present, whereas he imagines it was warm and nice and so on in the past. So those are the sort of three things that you would tend to do. Now, at some point, you would also be asked to look at the language. I'm not going to say too much about that, but if you move on to Mod 3A, you'd be asked to look at the language that's used in the poem and maybe occasionally make some comments on it. But it's our first glimpse, certainly in my lesson, of Old English poetry. And if we take line 5, Shiada Shorbeorga Shorana Yadrorana, remember SC is pronounced SH. Don't worry what that means, you can find it on your handout. But what can you immediately notice about that line of poetry? Sorry? Alliteration. So you've all said that like that, so obviously someone's told you this. Yes, Old English is alliterative verse. It links the two half lines by alliteration. Anything else? Okay, Shorana Yadrorana. What's going on there? Yeah, kind of. Well, assonance maybe, but internal rhyme, let's put it as that. Okay, so they do use rhyme as well occasionally, but not. There is end rhyme in a poem which we call the rhyming poem, because we haven't got any imagination in Old English, okay? So, line divided into two halves, short half lines, alliteration, rhyme, these are all things you will come across in Old English poetry. That is the manuscript where it survives. It's in a book called the Exeter Book, so it's in Exeter Cathedral, and that is the sole copy of this poem that we have. Now, first of all, you'll see that it's not laid out as you would get it in any of your books. It's just continuous. They just wrote and wrote and wrote the lines like that. And secondly, we're now getting a hint as to why there were dot, dot, dots in that poem. There's two great ruddy holes in the middle of the manuscript. So it kind of interrupts the text. They haven't written around these holes, so obviously they'd written over it and something's happened to the page at some point. So if you see this line, line 10, reacha after Otherum, Reacher after Otherum's there. You could follow it on. Ofstondon under stormum, under the storms. Stay up, ye dreas. Stay up, ye dreas. Now, there are words there, but this editor hasn't been brave enough. They've just gone, I have no idea what's happening here until somewhere around Mod Monada. Where is that? There. So they've given up with all of this. Whereas other editors might say, oh, I'm perfectly certain what I know what's going on there, okay? So, one thing again with Old English poetry and Old English literature, you will be going back to sources like this. You get Dickens, you know what he was doing, printed books in his lifetime, da-da-da-da, sorted. But in Old English, you've got to start making some quite complicated decisions about the text. Now, if you haven't worked out, that little image there is to do with a film. And there is a film version of The Ruin, which is available on YouTube. Don't laugh, I was kind of involved in this. Okay, so anyway, if you do want to go away and see the film version of The Ruin, sit there with your popcorn, you can do it. It's on YouTube, etc., etc. So, a bit of a taster of poetry, and next week we're going to be looking at poetry in a lot more depth. But what I want to concentrate on today is language and Old English, the language of Old English. Where does it come from? What about it? Some interesting things about that. And I think I mentioned this yesterday. English basically has a kind of success story which probably you wouldn't have imagined about it if you were thinking about English about 1100 years ago, you would have no idea. For example, in Oxford or England, wherever you want to be, 1600 years ago, there was no English spoken. Just didn't speak it here. It wasn't the native language of this country. With the exception of a few mercenaries that were hired by the Roman army, it wasn't here. But now, 300 to 400 million native speakers, used by millions more, etc., etc. And of the 2,700 world languages, you can dispute that figure if you wish, and dialects, it's probably, at the moment, still the most dominant language in the world. Spanish is coming up a close second, Chinese, of course, and Indian, etc. But nevertheless, it is the dominant language of the world, and this is quite interesting because it comes from a group of tribes which settled in England 1500 years ago. So how did that happen? So now I'm going to tell you the story of English. So you can sit back. Right, we're going to start a long, long time ago, 1800 BC, give or take a couple of hundred years, which is easy to do around that period. Now this is a theory, I'm just going to put it out as a theory, okay? But it is a general theory, which I think to a certain degree is accepted, but the dates are argued over, and indeed the point of origin is argued over. Some people shift it much further north, etc. But basically the theory goes like this, that at some point around that period, there was what we tend to term the Indo-European peoples, who spread out across Europe from, imagine this is, as you can see, Turkey, and they start spreading out east and west. And as they spread out, they take their language, their cultures, their myths, etc. with them. Now the reason we have this is on your handout, is, well, basically because in the 18th century, although it had been noted earlier, but in the 18th century, a philologist called William Jones, English philologist who actually went out and was based in India, noted, strangely enough, that there were words in Sanskrit which were very, very similar to words in Latin and Greek. And he thought, how can this be? And he basically posited a theory which we now call the Indo-European theory, that there was a common group of language and peoples from which all of these languages now descend. And what you're seeing here is a family tree. It shows you how language is related. You will notice there are a lot of languages missing from this, because this is just talking about the Indo-European family of languages, but they are there. So if we were to follow Indian down, you can see Sanskrit, etc., Iranian, Persian, Celtic, Irish, Welsh, Gaelic, Breton, and so on. Hellenic comes down to Greek. So the idea is that these people spread out. They were going with, they started with a common language, but they spread out, and over the time the languages changed, etc., and we started to see these families of trees which kind of relate geographically to where they went. Not everything. A good example of what resisted the Indo-European language is Basque. Mountainous people resisted, retained their own language. Pictish is another one, although it's died out. And some languages, such as Greek, occasionally have fossils from earlier languages, which obviously is their culture that they subsumed. So that's what that, we'll come back to that in a second. And then we have a spread. So this is kind of a modern map spread of languages, language families. You can see Germanic, which is green, Celtic just hanging on to the edges there. Few out there in Galway, hang on in there, boys. The Romantic languages here. The oddity, of course, is Romania. That was an outpost of the Roman Empire and then got cut off. And the real oddities are the Finno-Ugric languages. Then you've got Slavic languages, etc. So that's showing you a spread of languages. And it's the sort of thing you understand why. There are words very similar in French and Spanish and Portuguese and Italian, and words, as we will find out, very similar in the Germanic languages. Now, just before a slight digression, I do digress. That's a map of Europe. This is what the Anglo-Saxons thought Europe looked like. This was their map. That doesn't make much sense, so let's flip it that way. And there you can see the British Isles up there. Kind of got England sort of right. God knows what's happening up there. They knew, I think that's Thule or Iceland, and there's Ireland just, well, let's randomly draw a shape. Heaven knows what they're thinking of the Iberian Peninsula there with Jerusalem at the centre. Anyway, that's a map of the world. But notice that on their map of the world, there's an edge. It's not a globe. And that's why we have sayings like the four corners of the earth. And seeing as people kept asking me about it, they called the land, the world, Midgard, from like the Old Norse Midgard, which means middle earth. Okay, but returning to the Indo-European family of languages, what we're interested in is what we call the Germanic languages. So here we have the little tree, follow them down. You have North, East, West Germanic, which you can kind of make sense. The Northern Germanic peoples are like the Swedes, the Danes, Norwegian, Icelandic, Faroese. Okay, so that's what we call Northern Germanic languages. Eastern Germanic, Gothic, didn't last very long, died out. Western Germanic, you can follow it down here into High German, German, which is closely related to Yiddish, and there's an irony there, of course. And coming down here to Anglo-Saxon, Middle English, and Modern English, and forget these dates, they're not particularly accurate. And this leads us on to some interesting points of inquiry. Of course, this doesn't tell the whole story. As we know, after the Norman conquest, English starts getting infested with French words and things like that, and even before. What's next? Okay, so where were they speaking English? I've told you this before. 1600 years ago, Angles, Saxons, Jutes in northern Germany. So if you go back to the language tree, what you're basically saying is these were peoples who were roughly living around the same place. Of course, they all come back from where we're saying the Caucasian steppes or something like that. Roughly the same place. They could probably have understood each other. And indeed, in later Anglo-Saxon period, we know the Anglo-Saxons understood the Vikings to a certain degree. So they came here, Angle, Lower Saxony, and Jutland, to use a slightly more... come back to that. So the English, that was spoken in near southern Denmark, northern Germany, parts of it are hence the Germanic, that's why we call it, and that is why German man, our man, mouse, mouse, hab and have, sing and sing, hund, hound, heart, heart, etc. There are so many words very common in German and Germanic languages which are in English. And we still describe English as a Germanic language, which is, again, kind of ironic. Just to give you a bit more technical terms, you kind of talk about those things. You can just stick with that. But if you are interested in this, we tend to call this North Sea Germanic or Ingvionic, this area. And that's after a guy called Tacitus, a Roman or Latin writer from around the first century AD, who writes his famous Germania book, and he attempts, he's a Roman of course, he attempts to describe those barbarians the other side of the Rhine, the Germans, and tell you what they were about. It's an interesting and important book because it culturally tells us a lot of things about the Anglo-Saxons, or so that people try to apply to the Anglo-Saxons. For example, they used to get drunk a lot. They were very loyal. They went on, had fights, that sort of thing. And people read a lot into Tacitus. Unfortunately, Tacitus never went to Germany, so he's making it all up, but that's by the by. What's he doing? Oh, I remember, yes. Okay. Strange, isn't it? Just suddenly a Nazi appears on your screen. It's a bit like question time tonight. Okay. Right, the reason why I put that there is because when you start to read about this, and if you read about the history of these theories, and they are theories, but generally quite accepted, you do, if you go into the 19th century, start getting into some very, very dodgy territories because people started associating language with culture with race, and then they started making these assumptions that certain races had made a much greater contribution to world culture and therefore were superior. And this then, of course, was seized in the early part of the 20th century, and particularly by this bloke and his fellow nutters, and taken to, of course, extremes. Now, even now, I was looking at, there was an article in a newspaper today, I think it was The Telegraph, and someone had written some comment about what's happening tonight and the BNP, and linking that to these bizarre theories about the Anglo-Saxons. The fact that morons like this distorted that theory and built into it all their kind of prejudices and hatreds does not mean that we should disassociate ourselves from studying this period of language, literature and culture, but we just have to be very careful. So it's just a word of warning, a bit like last week, the Old Norse. Be careful. You will come across some very, very odd things, and that's why you get extreme right-wing people talking about Anglo-Saxons. However, let us return to more pleasant people, the Frisians. So, this little link here is quite nice, and why this is important is because what we commonly say is that the language spoken in Frisia, Friesland, is very, or the nearest we have, the nearest living survivor we have to Old English. Anyway, so you can understand, look, Old Frisian from the 14th century, once I give you a couple of words, God made Adam, that's modern English of course, that Beneter the bones, Fon the sterner from the stones, that flask the flesh from the earth, the blood from the water, and the heart from the wind. So you can see language, and then you get Fon in German, etc., etc., etc. So when we start looking across these older languages, we're going back now here, you can see words very similar. So this is quite old, Old Norse, Old High German, Gothic, the one that dies out, modern English, okay, telling you what there. So father, 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 etc. Thu, do, thu, thou. That's not modern English. Anyway, thank you, Mr. Robinson. And this is great stuff. This is really interesting stuff. If you want to go and explore. And it's these sorts of things that begin to answer certain queries. For example, why is it in the Latin languages or the Romance languages you tend to have a per as opposed to a f in the Germanic languages and so on? Why do we? And there's common patterns here, all going back to these early roots when the people spread out around the world. All kinds of things there, patterns. If you do want to find out about that, there's a couple of laws, not as in you'll break the law, but these are laws called Grimm's Law and Werner's Law, which are basically people in the 19th century went and studied these things and tried to explain it, how it happened, and they still work. Grimm is of the brothers Grimm, who you may have heard about the fairy tales, and there is a film, would you believe, about Grimm's Law and Werner's Law. So what I'm just saying there is there's some nice films, three films. It explains you all through the roots of those things, Grimm's Law and Werner's Law, if you want to pursue that. But generally what we're saying is here, if you look at languages, particularly those older medieval languages, there are patterns here, and this is important because it tells us a lot about where English comes from and English its relatives. And by knowing where its relatives are, we can work our way back and start helping us tackle some of the issues to do with Old English. And it carries on. Lovely poem by Thomas Hardy, the pity of it written in 1915. This explains why when he was walking in the loamy Wessex lanes afar from rail track and from highway, and I heard in field and farm said many an ancient word of local lineage like thou bist, if you know your German, er war, ich wall, er scholl, and by talk similar down in Wessex, because this is a survival from the olden days of those early Old English language, the Old English language, and of course, which is Germanic. And what he's saying here, isn't it ironic? I go through Wessex and I'm hearing people basically speaking German, and we're a year into a war with them. Right, okay, sorry, you have to do a bit of history. I know you hate it, but anyway, let's go through. So I've mentioned things like the migration period, so this comes back to those early days. And I'll tie this into the literature. So the text that you would be looking at when we're looking at these early part of Anglo-Saxon England, Beowulf, because it's talking about stories in mainland Sweden. Bede's Ecclesiastical History, the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle. Okay, so just to tell you how it happened, there was a collapse of Roman Britain. Sometime in the early 5th century, the legend, of course, goes that the Anglo-Saxons were invited over. They came over and thought, this is rather nice, and seized it. That's probably not true. But basically, Roman Britain, or the Romans, were retreating out of Britain mainly because of raids from these people around the coast, the Picts, the Scotti from Ireland, and the Saxons themselves. Isolated though it was, it sought help from Rome, I should say, and didn't get any. So they pull out. And then we have 449, what Bede calls the Adventus Saxonum, when the Saxons come, the Anglo-Saxons come to England. And this is a migration, it's not an invasion. People are coming over here because it's a better way of life. Much nicer than living in that area of Europe because it's not easy to cultivate, etc. So come over here, there's wide open fields, etc. And there's no one really properly resisting you. Or we'll come across that second. As I said last week, there were people who were still here, the British. And if you find a book called Gildas, The Ruin of Britain, that's someone who was here when the Anglo-Saxons were coming and giving you his side of the story. I've shown you this map, I think. So we have invasions across. This is to show you that the Germanic nations en masse were charging across Europe. But the yellow ones are the ones that we're particularly interested in. And what happens is you get tribes to kingdoms. So I don't know where you're from around here. If you're from Britain, then you might want to work out when they got to you. Early 6th century, they start expanding. So imagine east to west, Wiltshire, what we're now calling Wiltshire, Gloucestershire, Lincolnshire, northeast Yorkshire. It's around the time that Beowulf is set. 597, Christianity arrives in England with St. Augustine coming from. That's, of course, nonsense. Christianity was here quite a long time before that because the Roman Empire was Christian. So there were Christians here. It's just that when the Anglo-Saxons came, there were pagans. The Christians are pushed to the edge, Wales and Ireland, and then it reinserts itself through the power of Rome. There was British resistance, that sort of Dunkirk spirit. And you might hear of the Battle of Mount Baden. No one knows where Mount Baden is, and no one really cares, apart from it seems to have slowed up the Anglo-Saxon march. The reason why it's important, or people think it's important, is it's possibly, maybe, just about, who knows, that where a certain man, possibly, maybe, if possibly, called Arthur, fought. Arthur is the bane of our lives. Late 6th century, expanding into Staffordshire. Good luck to them. War bands, tribes, and what you're seeing there is culturally, they're moving from a very sort of, kind of barbaric, but a tribal culture into kingdoms, and there were 40, 50 kingdoms in the early Anglo-Saxon period, many, many more, until we eventually get it down to the Heptarchy, the main kingdoms which you have possibly heard of. These were separate entities ruled by separate kings, but they all ring today. Northumbria, East Anglia, Essex, Wessex, Sussex, Mercia, mainly in the police force, Kent, etc. Okay, I don't really tend to talk about Sutton Hoo, but you've heard of Sutton Hoo. It's that great ship find in East Anglia, and that's around the 7th century. And the reason why that's important is because it shows just the level of skill and craftsmanship that was around at that time. But also, that's quite an interesting discussion going on there because there's some Christian ideas in that burial. But if you're a Christian, why do you bury goods with yourself? You don't, basically. Right. Come back to the theme of the talk, where they settled had a direct effect on language. So, the main kingdoms of Anglo-Saxon England, they did eventually conquer Cornwall, but it took a bit of time. Now, why that map is interesting is that we have dialects in Old English. So people go to different parts of the kingdom and they speak, spell, etc. in different ways. This is not unheard of, as I will show you in a second. And there are main dialects that we have: Northumbrian, Mercian, West Saxon and Kentish. So you will occasionally hear reference to a poem and saying that's in the Kentish dialect. That's what it means. It will just, it will look like Old English, but it will look slightly different. The interesting thing about this is in some dialects they had specific words which then survived. So the example here, Mercia, which is the north, the Midlands, the words nowith and awith mean nothing or anything, and that's why in the north people used to say now and out. I don't know if they still say it, but that's the survival of Mercian. Yeah, okay. You don't say that down south. Well, you might do. People wonder what the hell you are. Now, that's kind of interesting, but all you've got to remember is that the dialect you will come across throughout most of your studies, apart from one or two texts, but the bulk of it is in something we call Late West Saxon. And that's all tied in with the history. Late West Saxon means 10th, 11th century onwards. And I'll talk about why that is later, but that's what you will see reference to. So we do have dialect accents in modern English. Don't have a go at the Anglo-Saxons. They're still there. And if we were all from these various areas of Britain spelt the words as we pronounce them, you'd get all kinds of nonsense coming out. So Cockney, Scouse, Geordie, that sort of thing. If you think about it, a word like house, let's say house is what 10 people pronounce here. Hass in London or East London. Hoos up north, etc. in Geordie land. So, okay, things are changing. Things are different. Everyone gets my accent wrong. I'm from Essex, by the way. But I sound like I'm from the sticks. So, let's just show you some examples of this. Is anyone here from Northumbria? Oh, good. That's our widening participation out the window, isn't it? All right. Well, there are people who live north of the Humber. It may come as a surprise to you in places like Sunderland and Newcastle and places like that. And they have different words. If you ever go up there, you will work this out. So, Ben, this is to help Southerners. Ben, child, gan, as with gan down pub, go, yammer, complain. I don't know if all of these are true, but anyway. And that's the Old English dialect words. Bairn, Ben, child. There is a word, chilled, as well. Gan, go. Yeomrian, yammer, complain. Mitchell, muckle, big. Nah. No. And so on. And remember, Old English word for town was toon. So there you are. There's the toon army. Hoos. Knawen, kna. So, kind of explaining why things like that survive. Okay, the story of the language continues. And English is a particularly good language. I mean, if you can have a language as a living thing, that absorbs words from other people and from other cultures. So before they came over, the Anglo-Saxons, they were already doing trade with the Romans, so they were picking up words like belt, butter, street. From the British, as in the people who lived there, there's not many. There's a few. Avon, which means river. So the River Avon is river. They kind of didn't get that one right. What's that, Avon? Oh, right, the River Avon. No. Coombe means valley. Brock, badger, that sort of thing. A few words do. Then when Christianity comes over, they start picking up words, candle, angel, cow, from Latin again. When the Danes start settling down, we pick up other words, or call outlaw. Even before the French conquer, well, they're not really French, the Normans, cap on proud, post-conquest, castle, crown, and we keep doing this, okay, through language and language. So English keeps absorbing words, as England keeps absorbing other cultures, which is why it's such a great nation to live. Send that into question time tonight. So, let's just see this after yesterday. I'm not looking at were-rabbit. Okay, werewolf. So, let's just see, dude, this isn't about picking up words, but I want to find out the penetration of Old English. So there is a word in the Oxford English Dictionary, etymology, werewolf, Old English, occurs once, and you can see it appearing very similar words in Dutch, in German, and so on. Interesting enough, after yesterday's discussion, it does actually dispute that it comes from where, the Old English Dictionary. But what I really liked about this, I never knew this. This is just, I'm going to go and look at this. In a law code by Canute in the year 1000, they're passing laws against werewolves. Fantastic. Good for them. Ban them, that's what I say. They're a hazard. The other thing you can do with our, the Oxford English Dictionary is you could look up all words that were derived from Old English. So we say OE, because that's the abbreviation, etymology, start the search. The World Wide Web. 7,686 words the Oxford English Dictionary thinks have roots in Old English. And some of them you may think is odd, aardvark particularly, but it's going back through the common Germanic roots, abbot, abbotrich, etc. That's a lot of words which go back, and they're the common ones. They're the ones we tend to use. And they're also the words which also have, to a certain degree, you might find in 17th, 18th century novels which have now died out. Which is why the French are fighting a losing battle. There is a certain... I mean, I can see why they're doing it, but this was last week, trying to protect the French language from words coming out of computers and the internet. Every now and then, 5 or 6 years, the French get upset about this and start saying, now it's cloud computing, they don't want words like that. If you ring-fence a language, preserve it, an aspect or whatever, it's not going to survive, it's not going to expand. That's my view, looking at the history, so... Don't think they're in. But remember, Old English is English. That's what the Oxford English Dictionary just showed us. Here's a bit of Old English. There it is in its manuscript form. Not a very good one, but there it's transcribed. The words appear in Britain at Eland is echte hund mile lang and twa hund brad and her sind on this Eland fivje theodor English and British and Welsh and Skittish and Pictish, etc. Of Britain, Ireland is 800 miles long. This is the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle and B. They didn't quite get the distance exactly right. 200 miles broad. And here in this island are 5 languages. English, British, Welsh, Scottish and Pictish. And Book Latin. But hopefully you can see if you go from that to that. Don't worry about going to the top one. But good luck to you if you can. You can see the word surviving. And it's not too difficult. Okay, quick test. Which of the following of those are not in Old English? This is a test for people from yesterday. None of them. You're right. Look. Queen is the one, but I gave you that yesterday. And you can do that with loads and loads of words. Go in the Oxford English Dictionary, look up the words and see what you think. And you will find that the etymology is Old English. Again, it's the idea there that, you know, if you repeat Old English, hear it, listen to it, you can hopefully see some similarities. Does using Old English mean you're being rid of? Often you hear about, oh, you used a bit of choice Anglo-Saxon. If you look them up, and I'm sure you've all done this at some point in your life, looked up the rude words in a dictionary, you will find out their etymological root is generally not from Anglo-Saxon at all, but people associate Old English with bluntness, with coarseness, which is wrong. But again, it's a misuse of the term. And on the back of your handout, beneath the Indo-European tree, it's a few years old, this article now, but it attempts to show that a certain politician there called John Reid, if you remember him, started to use words which defined him as posh because he was using more and more words which are derived from the French and so on. And that, people think, tends, if you hear it, moves you up. It's an attempt to be posher than you probably are. Whereas people who speak plainly tend to use more words derived from the Anglo-Saxon. I don't know if that's true or not, but anyway. Let's test it out. I don't know who optimumcoms.co.uk are, but they did something odd, and they got some writers that you've probably heard of, Thomas and Wordsworth and Eliot, and they analysed their text to see how many words were derived from Old English. So Jane Austen uses 74.1% of her words are derived from Old English. And in blue is the indication of where there is a truth. A universally acknowledged isn't that a man of a good must be in of a wife, etc., etc. Okay, let's try Eliot. It's probably not going to work. Oh, Eliot, 78.4%. See, there you are, T.S. Eliot, far better writer. 7% better. Anyway, so there is a sort of general feeling that if you are using those words, and they are, linguistically, we think, coming back. That's nothing to do with the Anglo-Saxons, of course, but people are reverting back to speaking plainer. They're ditching these convoluted languages. Okay. Here's another example of Old English. Again, why it's important, why it tells us a bit about our language, kind of related to the Hardy thing. This is the verb to be in Old English. Ich eam, thou art, heo, heo, hit, is, here, see, sindon. Ich beo, thou bist, heo, heo, hit, bith, here, see, bith. And fortunately, there are two verbs to be in Old English. And this may be the one you'll recognise: I am, you are, he, she, it, is. This probably isn't familiar to you, but this, again, linked to Hardy, is why people, if you go down the West Country particularly, they might say, I be doing that, you be doing that, and things like that. It's a survival of this. Curious thing about this, of course, the form of they are is like the German form, particularly, sie sind on, which didn't survive. In fact, we say they are. So neither of the Old English they are survive, and that's because they are is taken from Old Norse. So it's a complicated story. All kinds of things happening, but a fascinating one nevertheless. Okay, speaking Old English, how does it sound? People say, well, how do you know how it sounds? I say, because I do. I've been studying it for 20 years. Geez, 30 years, sorry. Okay, anyway, that's how I know. But it does, we know it because of rules in the poetry, which we can match up words, pronunciation, but also because everything I've just been saying up to now, we can find out, well, how did words were sounded or pronounced in other languages? Languages have survived. We can work back and get some ideas. So, pronounce everything. If you are reading Old English out, I picked this up yesterday, but just to let you know, there's two forms of pronouncing G, G or Y. So that may look like hard as in Old English God, which is fine, it is God, but not as in geared, that is yeard, as in your yard, where you might go out and play. Ch and k, so that's why that first word isn't chinning, which is probably something you might do in a pub. It's kunning, as in king, and the soft one is ch, churl, as in churlish or churl. And as I said yesterday, you will find dots above certain characters to explain this. Okay, let's just explain that a bit more, because again, this is another area, if you're interested in language, you can go off and explore, why do we have a g and a y and a k and a ch? And the answer lies in this little diagram here. Has anyone seen one of these before? Okay, good. All right, for those of you who haven't, that's kind of like a cross-section of your mouth. There's your Old English nozu, your lips, your wella, your goma, your tooth, your tongue, your throatu. Okay, so that's your teeth and your lips. And what it's telling you there, these is where you pronounce vowels from. And you can try this at home. A, o, u comes from the back of your throat. E, I comes from the front of your mouth, occasionally. And what we find, this is why it pronounces the k and the ch sound. These vowels tend to go with a soft ch or a soft y, whereas the back, the dark vowels, the nasty vowels, go with a g or a k. So it doesn't always work, but hell's teeth. Here's that one I like. So we would write that Gipswick. It's actually Ipswich, as in the place Ipswich in East Anglia. Okay? So that's why those rules sort of apply. That's where it comes from. Okay, problems with Old English. Quite a bit. All right, what are the problems with Old English? I think I said this a bit yesterday, but there is the main problem, apart from knowing what the hell the words mean, but I've tried to indicate that you can... It's not that difficult because a lot of them do have a history which then becomes a modern English word. Not all of them, but some of them. Is syntax. So when you start looking at Old English, you'll see, and translating it, and you may have already come across this, the word order isn't exactly right. And that's these two examples. So much only in this hour of doubt, I may now say, that's the kind of sort of Old English sort of syntax. It doesn't quite ring right. It's why Tolkien mixes around these things here. And that's what he's trying to sort of archaize his particular text, or this chap here. If you think of the way Yoda speaks, it's often sort of in odd syntax. The word order isn't quite right. And David Crystal, who's a brilliant linguist, actually analysed, I think, Yoda's speech patterns and worked out it was kind of Old English. So that's a particular problem you might have. But there is also, what do the words mean? And there, survival, similar languages, as I said, Latin glosses, when we look at that, that's how we find out. You do have a range of dictionaries, not just Mitchell and Robinson, so you can go and weigh and look at them. And online, this was in the news, I think, this morning, actually, they've launched the Thesaurus of English. And here's the Thesaurus of Old English. So if you were particularly interested in a modern word, let's try C. You will see the Old English words associated with it. Now that's kind of interesting because you'll then start to see patterns. You look at modern English words, look them back, and you'll see all the various things. It's also interesting if you ever set an essay, thematic essay, you could go away and do those searches. Okay, let's finish up just having a look at some more Old English. This isn't genuine Old English. It's made up Old English. It's the practice sentences from Mitchell and Robinson. But they may look completely nonsense, but if you try remembering those ideas about pronunciation, then hopefully you will work back. So the first one is easy. Harold is swift, his hand is strong, and his word grim. All perfectly good Old English. Late in life, he went to his wife in Rome. Again, perfectly good Old English. They would have said, later in life, he went to his wife in Roma. Next one. Now, remember that funny P with the ascender and the dots? So it might look like, is his pegna hair geet? But it is actually, is his thane here yet, as in the thane of Cawdor? His ring is gold, his dish, not disc, dish, glass, and his belt, leather. His chicken ran from his horseway, way of the horse, a bridle path, over his path and in his yard, into his yard. So fish, the fish, sir is the, swam under that ship and over the shellfish. Se knicht is on thar a bridge. The knicht, it's not knigget, as in Monty Python, knight. It's the boy. The boy is on the bridge. So by reading it out, by pronouncing it, you hopefully will get yourself somewhere. It's kind of what I was saying yesterday. All right. And that is the story of English. But it's a fragmentary story. It's a ruined story. There are bits missing, bits we make up. Some bits theoreticians really take for their own purposes, misuse, and bastardise, I suppose would be the best way of putting it. A bit like the poem The Ruin, which we started off. So, Germanic language, most akin to Frisian. Borrowed words from other languages and has dialects, but you've only got to worry about Late West Saxon, that's all you'll come across. Many Old English words are used today. Honestly, they are. Old English was an inflected language, which we came up yesterday, and you need to know a few rules to help you pronounce Old English. If you know those rules, it will really help you getting on. But hopefully, I've given you a brief history of English up to around the period of the Norman Conquest. Next week, there is a second translation workshop if you want to come, 4 to 5 on Wednesday, looking at the next stage. There is the website, discussion area, the chat room. If you're having problems, let me know. And predominantly, we're going to just concentrate on literature. So what Old English poems are there? Where do they survive? How does Old English poetry work? How is it performed? And I've no idea what that last bit means, but it will make sense next week. Okay, thank you very much.